Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with North Korea's bellicose response to a new round of UN sanctions imposed as a result of a recent North Korean nuclear test. Charles Armstrong, the director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University and author of the forthcoming book Tyranny of the Weak, North Korea and the World, 1950 to 1990, joins us to discuss North Korea's threat of a nuclear strike against the United States. Then we'll speak with Dr. Robert Lustig, the country's leading expert on childhood obesity and its connection to high fructose corn syrup and sugar that is prominent in processed food. We will discuss Dr. Lustig's new book, Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease, and whether American consumers can free themselves from the corporate food products that are killing them. Then finally, we'll examine the latest filibuster against President Obama's nominee to fill John Roberts' seat on the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit that has been vacant since 2005 due to the routine and consistent use of the filibuster by Republican senators. Erwin Chemerinsky, the founding dean and distinguished professor of law at the University of California Irvine School of Law, joins us to discuss how Mitch McConnell's brazen obstruction of Obama's judicial nominees has slanted the federal judiciary in a heavily conservative direction. Joining us now is Charles Armstrong, who is a professor of history and the director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University. His books include The North Korean Revolution, 1945-1950, A History of the Peninsula's, titled simply The Koreas, Korean Society, Civil Society, Democracy, and the State. And his latest book out soon is Tyranny of the Weak, North Korea and the World, 1950 to 1990. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Armstrong.
Nice to be with you.
And obviously, North Korea has said provocative things in the past, they haven't really responded to the UN sanctions, which were passed, by the way, with a 15-0 vote on the Security Council. And they were crafted and drafted with the United States and China, North Korea's principal ally. Do you expect more statements to come forth, short of the more recent one that threatened nuclear war?
We can expect more provocative statements. Certainly, North Korea has made them many times in the past when it feels that it is threatened, and we haven't seen it actually take action for the most part. You know, so we can't take their overheated rhetoric all too seriously. But we are entering, I think, a very potentially dangerous situation, and there is the possibility, not of a nuclear attack on the U.S., which I think North Korea is not capable of and is not foolish enough to attempt, but more small-scale actions on the Korean Peninsula between North and South. That's actually what concerns me more than the possibility of a nuclear war.
Well, on Wednesday, there was a fairly blunt response from the South Korean army general, who called a news conference and warned that if South Korea were provoked, they would strike back at top North Korean military leadership. And of course, in 2010, there was an exchange of artillery fire raining down on a South Korean island. And prior to that, a South Korean warship was sunk with a loss of 46 South Korean sailors, I should say. So, is that an escalation? Is that different? The South has quite often been quite restrained in their response to North Korean provocations.
Yes, they have. But in fact, many people in South Korea feel they were too restrained in 2010 and should have taken stronger action. There's a new president in South Korea who comes from a right-of-center party, and I think there's a lot of pressure on her to stand up to North Korea and be tough. That could lead to a situation where if there is a provocation or even a sense of a potential provocation from the North, the South could respond and things could escalate very quickly and very dangerously.
So, again, I'm speaking with Charles Armstrong. He's a professor of history and director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University. His latest book out soon is Tyranny of the Weak, North Korea and the World, 1950 to 1990. The fact that the North Korean television feature General Kim Yong-chol, who's the head of North Korea's military intelligence, he's apparently a hardliner that South Korean officials have felt was involved in these 2010 attacks. And he was the person who read one of these provocative statements on television, threatening on Tuesday to use lighter and smaller nukes against the United States. Did you give us a sense of reading the tea leaves there? And the conventional wisdom is that this dynasty, of the Kim family dynasty, the new 28-year-old leader is not tested yet, and he has to show his bones, and maybe he's being provoked by his own military. I mean, how do you read it?
I think that there is some truth to that. He is a new, young leader. The old military guard is still there to a great extent, although there have been some personnel changes. He has to show that he's tough, that he's standing up to the Americans, to the South Koreans. And a lot of what they say is intended for domestic consumption as much as it is for an international audience. Having said that, I think that Kim Jong-un does inherit his father's desire to demonstrate North Korea's military power, that he went ahead with the nuclear test explicitly on his father's orders. One of his last wishes before he died in 2011 was that they would carry out these satellite launches and nuclear tests. And I don't think we should make too much of the differences between Kim Jong-un and the rest of the leadership. They are, I think, generally united on showing a very strong front to the outside world, and in particular responding very forcefully to the threat of sanctions, which now apparently will be put into force.
But the sanctions seem to be specifically targeted against them and against the patronage system that the Kim family have in buying the loyalty, if indeed they have to. I mean, I've often wondered, there's this specialist on South Korea, Brian Myers, has written a book suggesting that in many ways we've got it wrong here in the West in analyzing and labeling this North Korean regime as a kind of Stalinist throwback, when in fact it may be more similar to the Imperial Japanese regime in the 1930s. So do you agree with Brian Myers that the definitions aren't very precise about what kind of regime this is?
I think I agree to the extent that we do misunderstand North Korea as a Stalinist regime. It's a highly personalist, family-oriented regime, and in that sense, it's actually very different from the Imperial Japan wartime regime, which was, although it had a symbolic emperor, he himself did not have the kind of power, and his family did not have the kind of highly concentrated, personalized power that we have in North Korea today. Furthermore, North Korea is not an expansionist, imperialist power like Japan was. It is a very defensive country that sees itself surrounded by these hostile forces, in which I think the leadership, to a certain extent, generally believes are out to destroy them. So they've managed to survive for 60 years, for 20 years now, after the fall of the Soviet Union. So I think to simply see them as a kind of leftover of communism is a misunderstanding. They're a very tough, xenophobic, nationalistic regime, and they have to be taken seriously.
But at the end of the day, we keep ratcheting up sanctions, and under President George W. Bush, he called them names, and eventually, after you've done all the posturing, you still have to sort of go back to dealing with them. And the only people that appear to be able to have any leverage are the Chinese. And a lot of analysts are now suggesting that these new round of sanctions that have been largely crafted by the Chinese at the United Nations Security Council may indicate a change of attitude on the part of the Chinese. Do you see that as a possibility?
Well, it might. We'll have to see. So far, the Chinese haven't been very forthcoming with putting into practice the sanctions that they've signed on to. These sanctions look tough on paper, but in reality, if China isn't willing to go through with them, they're not going to have much of an effect. But it's also not clear what their effect could be even if they were put into practice. They're not going to undo the nuclear weapons that North Korea has already made. They could be intended to punish them, but they're not going to stop, although they may slow down its nuclear program going forward. So at the same time, and the Chinese, as well as the Russians, have said this, we need a more comprehensive strategy that includes the possibility of diplomacy and negotiating with these people. Sanctions, even targeted sanctions like this, are not going to really change their behavior unless there's a way out. Backing North Korea into a corner is not a very good strategy and can, in fact, lead to some very unpleasant results.
So what about the idea that these sanctions are, targeting the elite, and what I assume is a kind of patronage system that the family use to buy loyalty, if short of the sort of godlike adulation that they have. You know, they're banning, for example, the export of expensive jewelry, yachts, luxury automobiles, racing cars, etc. And they're also forcing the North Koreans to carry around large suitcases filled with cash, moving their illicit funds. And the resolution also requires states to inspect suspect cargo on their territory and prevent any vessel that refuses an inspection from entering their ports. And new aviation measures, which call on UN states to deny aircraft permission to take off land or fly over their territory if illicit cargo is suspected to be aboard. So at least on paper, that seems like the squeeze is on a little.
Yes, it does. But again, we'll see how it actually is put into practice. The last time I visited Pyongyang, there were plenty of foreign cars and other things in the capital of North Korea that are supposedly banned by previous sanctions. But the other question, and the more important question, is even if the sanctions do work, what effect will they have? Do we really believe that if the elite of North Korea don't get their cognac and can't buy their yachts, that they're going to rise up or they're going to pressure Kim Jong-un to behave differently? I somehow doubt that. These sorts of pressures only have a certain limited effect. We also have to have some kind of a channel of negotiating our way out of this. Otherwise, the status quo will just continue for a long time. And part of the sanctions will definitely hurt a lot of the population of North Korea after resources are diverted now to an elite that doesn't have the access they had before. So it's not necessarily the case that even the people who are the intended targets of these sanctions are really going to be hurt that badly.
So what are we playing, some kind of shadow game here to satisfy ourselves? Because quite often it seems that sanctions have to do with more with the side that's imposing the sanctions. They do it out of frustration. They can't do anything else. And it's made us feel good that we're doing something. But you've just described the possibility that one will be counterproductive it will hurt the people even more, because more of the scarce food, et cetera, will be diverted to the elites. And it seems to me that it comes on the North Korean side. They simply want America to acknowledge this regime and accept it. And is that where the lines are drawn between us finding that this is so unsavory, this regime, that we can't acknowledge it give it the respect that it is demanding, and having tantrums every time you don't give them what they want? Or and conversely, you know, does it come down to that's what they want, to be legitimized?
Yes, I think that to a great extent is what they want, but it's a very difficult way of expressing what they want, and it's certainly extremely difficult for the U.S. to accept North Korea and many other countries to accept North Korea as a nuclear power. But I think that's true. North Korea wants to be recognized by the United States. It wants to be taken seriously. And the strategy that the Obama administration has taken, which they've called strategic patience, is basically ignoring North Korea, and I don't think that's going to get us anywhere. Sanctions are being put into place to some extent because that's what we said we would do. That's what the U.S. threatened to do if North Korea had a nuclear test, so we have to carry this out. But it's not clear to me that there really is a serious and well-considered end game for where this will lead. It's not, as I said, going to get rid of North Korea's nuclear weapons, and it's not going to really solve the pressing problems of security and economic instability in North Korea. We have to have other ways to do that.
And Charles Armstrong, the assumption is that the Chinese have leverage, but I imagine that at least within the Chinese military, the hardliners probably are perfectly happy to have North Korea drive the Americans crazy. And they also don't want a collapsed regime in the North, which would mean that the U.S. military would be on the Yellow River again. So is that a factor? I mean, what keeps China supporting this regime that clearly is annoying it at the moment?
Well, there are different feelings within the Chinese leadership. There is a great deal of frustration about North Korea's behavior. China explicitly told North Korea before the nuclear test in February not to go through with this, and they did. But there's only so much China can do. As they keep saying, North Korea won't buckle down and do what you tell them just because you have economic leverage. They're a tough customer. There also is an element within China that is most concerned about instability in North Korea, and above all, as you say, they don't want to see North Korea collapse and the U.S. military up on their border on the Yalu River. So North Korea is a convenient buffer for them. They want to not allow North Korea to go forward with these provocative sorts of actions, but they don't want to pressure them so much that the regime becomes unstable or even collapses.
So at this point, Charles Armstrong, again, professor of history and the director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University and the author of the forthcoming book out soon, Tyranny of the Weak, North Korea and the World, 1950 to 1990. Does this situation come down to, in spite of the threats of nuclear war against the United States, which the U.S. is quick to say they can handle, I forgot to mention that we had the basketball player from the Chicago Bulls there recently in North Korea coming back saying that Kim Jong-un doesn't want to do war. Mm-hmm. I'm quoting exactly what he said. But it looks like if they want to do any kind of war, it'll be with the South or it'll be some kind of provocation. And is that what worries you, the possibility that the South are also pretty hardline at the moment and next time around, they may not roll over and be accommodating?
Yes, as I said, there's a new administration in the South as well, a new president who's untested, who is the first female president of South Korea. And she will be under pressure to respond forcefully to the North if there's a future provocation. And even what North Korea has done and said it would do so far is, in a sense, a provocation to South Korea. So we have to be very careful going forward of something escalating out of control. For example, the U.S.-South Korean military exercises going on have evoked some pretty bellicose language from North Korea. And it was in that context in November 2010 that North Korea lobbed artillery shells at the South Korean island of Yeonpyeong. They said it was because of these military exercises South Korea and the U.S. were doing in the area. So I think that is the real danger, much more than North Korea one day launching a nuclear missile at Washington, which is it is incapable of doing anyway.
Well, Charles Armstrong, I thank you very much for joining us here.
You're welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Charles Armstrong, who is a professor of history and director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University. His books include The North Korean Revolution, 1945 to 1950, A History of the Peninsula, titled The Koreas, Korean Society, Civil Society, Democracy, and the State. And his latest book out soon is Tyranny of the Weak, North Korea and the World, 1950 to 1990. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back talking to the country's leading researcher in the causes of childhood obesity.